The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events, and I'm pleased to welcome all of you here this evening. So why is this night different from all other nights? On all other nights, we discuss Vic, Halliday, Bynum, and Briere. On this night, we discuss Koufax, Greenberg, Goldberg, and Epstein. On all other nights, we have authors present books with sensible titles. On this night, the title is an oxymoron. On all other nights, we are polite and don't get into arguments. On this night, I fear there might be a significant difference of opinion. On all other nights, we have one writer. On this night, we have a mishpacha. And they are Franklin Foer, editor-at-large of the New Republic, and a Schwartz Fellow at the New American Foundation, Mark Tracy, staff writer at the New Republic, and a 2011 National Magazine Award winner for The Scroll, a blog he edited at Tablet Magazine, David Plotz, editor of Slate and author of Good Book, The Bizarre, Hilarious, Disturbing, Marvelous, and Inspiring Things I Learned When I Read Every Single Word of the Bible, and Mark Leibovich, writer for The New York Times and winner of a 2011 National Magazine Award for Profile Writing. Please welcome tonight's writers.
Hi, I'm Frank Foer, and I edited this book with Mark Tracy over there, who I've known for a very long time. We grew up together in Washington, D.C. I'm quite a bit older than him, which you can't tell, I'm sure. But he went to the same synagogue that I went to, the same school that I went to. His cousin was my best friend. And we've shared the same obsession with Jews and sports, both independently, Jews and sports as independent obsessions, and then Jewish sports as a shared obsession. And one day we were going back and forth an email. Mark was working for the magazine Tablet, and he was trying to get me to write a piece about a Jewish soccer owner in London. And the idea kind of came to us that we could basically play an even nerdier form of fantasy baseball than the nerdy form of fantasy baseball that most people play. And that would be that we would get the writers that we admired most in the world to write about the Jewish athletes that they admired most in the world. And so we went about going to novelists and journalists and soliciting essays from them. And it was some of the easiest work that we've ever done in our life, because it turns out that a bunch of nerdy Jewish writers want nothing more than to write about Jews and sports. And so we assembled a very venerable list of contributors, and they wrote about subjects. We had David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, wrote about Howard Cosell. One of the jokes of the book is that our definition of the Jewish jock is an extremely expansive one. And so he wrote about Cosell. We had the great English historian Simon Schama wrote about Daniel Mendoza, a bare-knuckle boxing champion from late 18th century London, the first Jew ever to meet an English monarch. And we stocked the book with all the people that you'd expect to see in the book. We have essays about Sandy Koufax, which is written by Jane Levy, who was his great biographer. She wrote an essay about Sandy Koufax coming to her daughter's bat mitzvah. We have an essay about Hank Greenberg by the great New York Times sports writer Ira Berkow, which is about whether anti-Semitism cost Hank Greenberg Babe Ruth's home run record. And so we got the essays that you'd expect, but we also have essays that you perhaps weren't anticipating in a book about Jewish sports. So we have the greatest Jewish bullfighter ever, who's also the greatest gay Jewish bullfighter ever, and was a crony of Ernest Hemingway's. We have the Jewish woman who fenced for the Nazis in the 1936 Olympics. We got the guy who invented Ultimate Frisbee. Yes, he's a Jew. Joel Silver, who was also the producer of the Matrix movie, Brewster's Millions, Die Hard, Die Harder, Die Hardest. And it adds up. And one of the points of the book is that, you know, there's this old Jewish joke that became kind of the world's joke about the book about Jewish sports being the short pamphlet. But the truth is that when you put it all together, Jews are actually pretty good at sports. And one of the implicit arguments in the book is that Jews have left their mark on sports in America much the same way that they left their mark on Hollywood and popular music and other parts of our culture. Well, tonight I'm very delighted and thankful to be joined on the stage by my co-editor Mark Tracy, who's there in the middle, and David Plotz, who wrote an essay about Carrie Strug, the Olympic gymnast, and Mark Leibovich, who wrote a beautifully reported and beautifully written essay about Theo Epstein, the general manager of the Boston Red Sox and now the Chicago Cubs. And we're going to have a little bit of a discussion up here about their essays and about the broader subject, and then we'll open it up to you all. But Mark is probably Mark. There's two Marks. Damn it. This is one of the problems about writing a book about Jews. Mark Tracy, why don't you just talk a little bit about the thesis of the book?
Sure. I mean, we have, as Frank was saying, you know, we have 50 individual essays. We were shooting for roughly 50 somewhere, and it was only at the end when we counted them all up, we realized we had exactly 50, which is very helpful because you can say 50 essays, and everyone knows what number you mean. 49, it gets, you know, pretty dicey. But each essay, you know, stands on its own and is a fun thing. But, you know, you notice a couple things if you read them all, which obviously I personally highly recommend you do. And that's that, you know, Jewish participation in sports, particularly over the past 100 years, particularly in America, has really evolved, you know, towards the beginning of the last century when many Jews were still recent immigrants. The basketball and boxing, which were the premier urban sports and the premier sports of New York City, which was about a third Jewish, you know, were really actively populated by Jews. So Frank's essay is about Benny Leonard, who was a great boxer, one of the greatest boxers of all time. There was Barney Ross. There were many lesser boxers. And basketball, you sort of have the same thing. Barney Cedran, we have a great essay about Barney Cedran, who was about 5'3", 5'4". He's the shortest player in the Basketball Hall of Fame. And Jews were really very much active in
Mark, do your proof where you show that
sure.
That basketball that Kobe Bryant's actually
a
Jew. Unknowing Jew?
Yeah. Basically, if you dig basketball about 100 years ago, you have the Jews who, you know, not to stereotype too much, but stereotypes are probably stereotypes for a reason. The Jews tended to be a little shorter, a little less brawny. In fact, one of the Jewish teams from one of the settlement houses on the Lower East Side was called the Dizzy Izzies because they were small and fast. And so one way they overcame and beat bigger teams was they imported a lot of concepts, especially from lacrosse. There was a coach named Harry Baum who came down and was a lacrosse player at Columbia. And so the no-look pass, the backdoor cut, all the things that are now commonplace in basketball, you know, he brought those down and put them into basketball. So that's like the 1910s, 1920s. By 1950, you have something called the City Game. And it's headquartered at City College, which is predominantly Jewish student body, predominantly Jewish players. The coach is a guy named Nat Holman. City College is the only school to ever win the NCAA and the NIT in the same year. This is when the NIT was something you actually wanted to win. And then, you know, it goes from Nat Holman. One of his players was a guy named Red Holtzman. Similar name, but different guys. And Red Holtzman goes on and coaches the New York Knicks. Legendary team. I know we were in New York last night. We got cheers for that and then nice laughter as I joked that the Knicks suck now. I know we're in a slightly different place. Philadelphia, of course, is a great basketball city. They had the Eddie Gottlieb's South Philadelphia Hebrew Association team. Is that right? And then he... Spaz, right, exactly. And then he... the Warriors was him, right? And then Dolph Schayes, who I wrote about, comes down and does the 76ers. They were the Syracuse Nationals. But back to New York, since, you know, I'm from New York, so I'm going to be a little bit of a hegemonist here. Phil Jackson was one of Red Holtzman's players on those Knicks. Phil Jackson takes lots of the concepts of the City game, the passing, the constant movement without the ball, turns it into the triangle offense, which is, of course, the offense that, with Michael Jordan and with Kobe Bryant, has won 11 NBA championships. And that's just one example. That's just one sport. You can do this with pretty much any sport.
Wait,
right?
So that makes Kobe Bryant Jewish?
Roughly. It makes him spiritually Jewish.
Okay, yeah. That's fine. I just want to... All right.
And what you'll notice, though, is that what happens is, I mean, as I just said, I went from players to coaches there. And that's sort of a similar story to what happens in boxing, of course, where, you know, now the only Jews who are in the ring tend to be immigrants from the former Soviet Union who are, you know, more socioeconomically similar to the Jews from Eastern Europe of a century ago. But you have people like Howard Cosell, you know, in the press box. You have people like Daniel Okrent, who was the first public editor of the New York Times and who is actually the inventor of fantasy sports. So if you are a fantasy sports player or if you have a son or granddaughter who is obsessed with fantasy sports, for example, if you're my parents and you have me who's obsessed with fantasy football, you have Daniel Okrent to blame. And what happened was, as in many other fields, Jews sort of receded a bit from the playing field. There's some exceptions. Baseball, we actually have a lot of great Jewish ball players right now. And, you know, maybe took a step back from the playing aspect, but actually became even more influential in terms of the way that people consume sports and people are sports fans.
Well, Mark, you were remarking today that you regretted not covering your bald kepi with your Red Sox kippah.
I wasn't regretting it. I mentioned it as a possibility, mm-hmm. But I do own one. Yes, my daughters were encouraging me to wear it, but I decided not to. So.
Well, I just think it's interesting that
you need a big kippah to cover this bowl.
I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, it your essay about Theo Epstein. There's some connection there between you've kind of grafted on your tribal loyalties to the Jews onto your tribal loyalties to the Red Sox. I don't know if that's fair. I mean, the Red Sox happen to be a team that's had a healthy number of Jewish baseball players.
They have. It's funny because
Mark's loyalty to the Red Sox is much deeper than his loyalty to the Jews.
Yeah. It's true, although not as much lately, and it's not because I've become more religious either. we've had a rough few years. No, I mean, I was blessed and very, very lucky to have been assigned Theo Epstein. Well, actually, I sort of volunteered. Well, I guess it was a great assignment because I grew up a Red Sox fan, and Theo Epstein he's sort of a hero to a lot of Red Sox fans and to a lot of baseball fans because he was the one who sort of put the team together that won the first World Series in 86 years in 2004. And as a baseball fan, one of the rights you have is to be smarter than every general manager of your team. But that became not true anymore when Theo Epstein took over. So I really took it upon myself to try to get to know him. He's a very reclusive figure. He's a total workaholic. And so I sort of got to know him through his parents, who are, in their own right, very, very, or his father in particular, is very, very accomplished. He's a novelist. His name is Leslie Epstein. He wrote a book called King of the Jews. And he's the head of creative writing at Boston University. And I spent the day after Thanksgiving with him last year eating Thanksgiving leftovers at their apartment in Brookline. And through like a maybe 3 or 4 hour conversation, I sort of became a part of this family in a weird way, to a point where Theo agreed to finally talk to me in Chicago. And one of the things I was really struck by was how, I wouldn't say guilt-ridden he is by his success. He won 2 World Series with the Red Sox. He had just recently left to go take over the Cubs after sort of a tumultuous breakup with the Red Sox. He grew up in Brookline. I grew up in Newton, which is the next town over. And he told me that he has always had a great deal of angst and sort of almost regret in his life that he hasn't done anything more worthwhile with his life, that he sort of succeeded in the toy department of sports, whereas his brother is a great do-gooder social worker who's done a lot of work for charity and worked for underprivileged or at-risk teens in the Boston area. His sister has been a very accomplished TV writer. His father is a novelist, and he said, you know, I was really ready to step away from baseball and to try to do something more maybe socially conscious with my life, and he was in the midst of a midlife crisis, but then the Cubs came along and offered him about $7 million a year, and he said, well, I guess I'll take this job instead. So much for that dilemma.
Right.
But anyway, it was a lot of fun, and I think it was getting to know him was just like one of the great gifts of being.
He's
part
like
of
one of the most Jewish characters in the whole book, I think. I mean, there's something. I mean, the guilt. Well, first of all, he's good with the numbers, right?
He's good with the numbers, yeah.
And that's key to his success in baseball.
Was he the youngest general manager?
He was. He was 29 years old. He was 28 years old when he took over. Then he was 29 when they won the World Series. I mean, he will always be a hero to a number of to Red Sox fans every year, everywhere. And speaking as one, I can certainly attest to that. So I did not come to this totally objectively. I'll say that.
By the way, his name is slipping my mind, but the general manager of the Phillies is half Jewish. What's his name? Someone? Right.
Ruben Amaro is half Jewish.
Mother's Jewish.
Really? I didn't know. See, it's amazing how many people know this stuff.
You know what? It's
like,
true.
You can actually
the audiences we've had for this book have been extremely knowledgeable, I've got to say, which goes to, I mean, kind of the core of the book, which is that there is this core Jewish obsession with sports, which we'll drill deeper in. But David, so if you know, Theo Epstein is kind of this quintessentially Jewish character with his angst and his inability to enjoy his success. Carrie Strug, you wrote about, it was not somebody I would instantly identify as Jewish, but in some weird way, she kind of is typical of the modern Jewish athlete, which is we don't play basketball so much. We don't box so much anymore. We're pretty good at baseball, pretty good at soccer. But it's these suburban, upper middle class sports that require tremendous investments of money and having parents schlep you all around the place that are kind of the quintessential Jewish games now, which would make Carrie Strug kind of a quintessential Jewish athlete.
So Carrie Strug, I feel like the need to remind everyone who Carrie Strug is, so if you'll bear with me, we go back to summer of 1996. It's the women's Olympic team competition. The United States is facing the Russians, who've won 10 gold medals in a row, and the U.S. has a pretty good team, the Magnificent Seven. And Carrie Strug is, she is known as the girl who chokes. She's the one who, when faced with a tough situation, would consistently fail. And it came down to a vault that she had to make. She needed to get a pretty modest score, about a 9.4. To clinch a gold medal for the U.S., and she, I'm sure many of you remember this, she went down, she did her first vault, and she landed on her butt, and she tore two ligaments in her left foot. And then she had one more vault to do. Her coach, who is the monstrous Bella Caroli, not Jewish, sort of exhorted her, told her, you've got to do this, you've got to do this, you've got to do this. And she went back down to the runway, and she went down, and she sprinted down, and she did this incredible vault, and she landed. I'll do her vault. Let me do her vault.
Okay.
So we're going to skip the vault part.
She landed it! Oh! Undertook us.
What? So she landed on one leg?
She landed on both legs and immediately pulled her damaged leg up. And she, you know, it was a 9.7. The U.S. wins the gold. And she goes on to be this, like, kind of pixie heroine.
The people in the audience right now are feeling it right now. They're reliving the moment. I can see it on their faces.
Yeah. You should be chanting, Carrie, Carrie.
Okay. All right.
Now, does actually picking your foot up, does it affect your score? Like, is that bad?
No, because she stuck the landing first.
She did stick it, so she kept it down long enough.
Yeah.
You do it only for a second.
Okay.
You stick the landing and then.
But then she, I mean, the kind of story of my essay is really about how this was it seemed to be this incredible moment of glory for her, and she was miserable because what happened was that in injuring herself, she had lost her chance to do the only thing she cared about, which was to compete in the individual competition, which follows the team competition. And she was absolutely miserable. And the thing that I talked to her about this, and she she retreated into her shell. She tried to go back to the gym the next day just to get the chance. She had been training her whole life. She effectively delayed her own puberty by training so hard in order to get a chance to qualify for the individual medal. And there she was. She won this gold medal. She didn't care about the gold medal. It didn't matter to her. What she wanted was the individual glory of the individual competition, and she wasn't able to do it. And it was only after the Olympics, when she emerges. She's on the cover of Sports Illustrated. She was really in seclusion at the Olympic Games. She's on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Bill Clinton keeps inviting her to various things. She sits next to Chelsea Clinton at a birthday party. She's on Saturday Night Live as the guest host. She realizes, oh my goodness, I've done something that is much better by failing, or much better by being hurt and not competing, than it would be had I made it. Which doesn't really have anything to do with her Jewishness.
No, but she stood on one leg, just like Rabbi Hillel did when I'll throw it up open to you guys. Growing up, did you have an obsession tracking down the Jews on the field? Was that something that
I had a bit growing up where it really manifested itself for me, actually, even more than in childhood, was for the last couple of years. I was at Tablet Magazine, which is a magazine of Jewish life and culture, my job was to write the daily blog, and there was no way I was going to write a daily blog about any subject and have it not include sports. So the first time I did that was during my first NCAA tournament. I decided that Tablet should have an official team to root for, and then I chose the Tennessee Volunteers because their coach was Bruce Pearl, who coached the Maccabi team. I wrote an article. There's an annual meeting of the Jewish Coaches Association at the Final Four every year. They have a brunch with bagel and lox on the Sunday before the Monday, and Bruce Pearl was at the inaugural meeting of that, along with a rabbi who's also a D3 coach.
Along with the alleged pedophile.
And Bernie Fine, they've recanted most of those allegations, but yes, Bernie Fine, the assistant Syracuse
coach. Not every Jewish jock is a superhero.
Something of a Shonda, perhaps, but the pickup I got, the site that linked to this article wasn't another Jewish site, but it was a Tennessee basketball site that was like, look, this Jewish magazine in New York, they're pulling for us. And they actually made the Sweet 16 that year despite being a high seed, so must have had some sort of effect. Pearl will be back. Pearl also had some slightly scandalous.
He's a Shonda, too.
Well, there's recruiting violations, but who doesn't, right? But so anyway, one way this manifested itself was...
There were several recruiting violations committed in putting together this book. Signing up authors.
One thing I did was we put together a way you could choose your all-time all-Jewish starting five, because there is a storied history of Jewish basketball players, and for it I talked to the greatest Jewish basketball player of all time, who's Dolph Schayes, who played for the Syracuse Nationals and then in their very first year the Philadelphia 76ers. And I sort of kept calling him up every so often, even after I got my initial interview with him. And sometimes I posted about it. Sometimes I did it for a reason. Sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I just sort of called him up. He owns a real estate firm in upstate New York, and he's 84 years old, and I kind of just love talking to him. And it's sort of was a way for me to connect with a past in which... I would call him and he'd be like, why are you calling me? And I'm like, well, because you're the greatest Jewish basketball player of all time and that's awesome. And he'd be like, what's so awesome about that? As I say in the essay, he told me, there were a lot of Jews in New York. We played basketball. I was one of the Jews that was playing basketball. I guess the Philadelphia story that comes to mind with him is his son Danny also played. He played for Syracuse and he played in the NBA. And there was an instance where... I'm sorry? He played for the Jazz. Yeah, he played for several teams. Back when he was playing for Syracuse, he was playing Temple at the Palestra, not far from here, and there was a bad call, and Dolph, his father, was in the stands and sort of charged the court, and according to a news report, four people had to hold him back from the refs, and he was ejected from the Palestra.
What's your all five? Who are your starting Jews?
Dolph was angry at me because we had Larry Brown as a – no, we had Grunfeld as a small forward, and he said he should have been a shooting guard. But my all-time starting five was Obviously, Dolph Schayes, a power forward. Larry Brown at point guard, also a great coach. Red Holtzman or Red Auerbach as the actual coach. They're both in the book. Max Zaslavsky, I believe, was my small forward. Grunfeld was my shooting guard. And for center, I cheated and put in Amari Stoudemire because you gotta go where you can. Amari Stoudemire is a great lover of the Jewish people, but is not himself. Yeah, he took a trip to Israel and briefly.
He studies Talmud.
And by the way, my official statistician would be Harvey Pollack. Do people here know Harvey Pollack? I got to hang out with Harvey Pollack. Harvey Pollack is the only person who's been employed in the NBA for every year of its existence. He is now the statistician for the Philadelphia 76ers, also the lacrosse team, I believe, and has done work with past basketball teams. So we did the Warriors and the other Warriors. He's the guy who invented the triple-double.
And actually, Dave Zinkoff would have to be the PA announcer, right?
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, thank you. Playing to the locals. Is he still alive?
Over 6,000 t-shirts in a row.
And Harvey has worn over 6,000 t-shirts every day. It's the Guinness World Record. Every day, a different t-shirt. I have a picture in my phone of Harvey Pollack wearing... it's actually a t-shirt with Hebrew on it was the day that I hung out with him.
So, I mean,
You guys are totally creepy. It's really, really spooky.
All right, but here, all right, that's a good point. There is something... I mean, the Jewish... like this is an obsession. I mean, it seems like there are several other people in the audience who possibly share the same obsession. And I think it's worth... it's worth putting ourselves on the couch to figure out what's going on here.
It is? Yeah. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
You have a theory?
No. It's actually sort of a supporting anecdote, which is I was having lunch not long ago with a Republican lobbyist in Washington who said, you know, I said, well, I'm doing this. I'm helping, you know, write this book on Jewish, you know, sports figures. He goes, you're kidding. It's like, yeah. So I play golf with about 10 Jewish guys every year in Arizona, and all they talk about for half the game is Jews in sports. Who's Jewish? Who's not Jewish?
Yep.
And you got to tell me when that book comes out. I'm going to buy 10 copies, one for each of them. I'm going to give it to them on Christmas.
We'll open up for questions in a minute, but I want to ask Plotz a question, and I want to expand on something myself. Mark mentioned golf. Now, there's a curious fact that we can point to all these sports where there are great Jews, and we get to golf, and they're isolated incidences. There's Amy Alcott is a great women's golfer. There've been some over time. In recent years, Corey Pavin was one of the few examples of great Jewish golfers, but he converted to Christianity, and so that negates him. Not for purposes of our book, where there's a chapter on Corey Pavin, but perhaps for the canon. All right, so the Mishkiach in the first row has deemed him kosher. David, do you have a theory for why there's so few Jewish golfers?
I have not thought about this.
I put you on the spot.
Okay. All right, so Jews don't start playing golf till pretty recently. We don't start playing golf probably till 60s, because we don't start suburbanizing until the 60s.
Not in Hillwood Country Club in Los Angeles. There have been Jewish country clubs for...
Really serious institutional way until...
Yeah.
Because Jewish suburbanization isn't until, what? It's like 50s and 60s.
True.
All right, so it's a relatively recent history compared to the WASP tradition. Nobody was good at golf until, except WASPs, until... very recently, right? And there are just very few Jews. I know you have a theory that there's some kind of element of Jewish neurosis here.
That's Bob Wright's theory. That's not mine. But
I think that's a totally bogus theory. Good, because that doesn't make any sense to me.
I mean, I think that there are two things.
I mean, okay. Also, golf is golf. If you look at very successful golfers, they're very predominantly Southern. Like it's like football. The culture of golf,
yeah.
Youth golf, is a Southern and Western thing. There are relatively few Jews there, so that's one thing. I don't know. What's yours?
Well, this isn't really mine. It's Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary and former President of Harvard, who actually was a contributor to this book. He wrote about Harold Solomon. Any Harold Solomon fans in the... the great tennis player, or semi-great tennis player from the 1970s. So he wrote about him, and It was actually, we did a panel with him and this famous linguist and science writer, Steven Pinker, who wrote about Red Auerbach. And it was like a logic puzzle for for Steven Pinker. I was like, you have 3 minutes to get from Red Auerbach to genocide. Go. And he like managed to do it. But Larry Summers makes the excellent point that how many players are there on the PGA
right,
Tour?
Right, that's my next point. There are only there are about 200 who are active PGA players, but there are only 20 that anyone knows the names of. So there's the total number, the total set of professional golfers people have heard the names of is 150 over the last 60 years. That is, you wouldn't expect there to be a lot of Jews there.
Right, but you'd still expect there to be, Jews are 3% of the population?
So you would maybe get three.
You want three or, but I don't think that
there's
there
Corey Pavin, that's one.
Yeah, but he doesn't count, except for the Mishkiach in the first one.
It's a term of endearment.
Anyways, perhaps somebody in the audience will have a theory, but I just wanted to make one point about why, my theory for why this subject is such an obsession for so many people, which is, in the introduction to the book, we go back to the ancient Greeks in the gymnasium, and which was so much a part of Greek culture. And you had a Jewish revolt against the Greeks, and there was this whole big impetus. There was against assimilation, and there was a whole set of assimilationist Jews, and this is what the whole Hanukkah story is based on. A set of assimilationist Jews who would crinkle up their foreskin. In order to create foreskin, in order to be able to plausibly wrestle nude in the Greek gymnasia. And I think over the ages, games have been something that have been primarily identified with Gentiles.
Syracuse guy like that.
Yeah, no, there's no demonstration. No Kerry Strug like demonstrations for that one, please. Games have been associated with Gentiles and with assimilation, and there's been a Jewish resistance to that over time. And there's also been an anti-Semitic caricature about the Jew, that the Jew is bookish and wan and effeminate and spends so much time playing, reading their Talmud that they're kind of less than manly. And so then we get to, that caricature exists, and I think to a certain extent it was internalized by Jews. And one of the reasons that we know that it was internalized by Jews is that it became an important part of Zionism. If you go back and you, there's a character in our book, Max Nordau. I don't know if anybody's heard of Max Nordau. But when Zionism was created, he was the most famous Zionist in the world. Theodor Herzl was kind of riding his coattails. And Max Nordau was an aesthete and a playwright and a great journalist, and he didn't really identify as being a Jew at all. And he'd written a book called Degeneration. And this was before he'd even begin thinking about Jews. And he'd argued that Europe was going to hell because people were spending too much time indoors. They were becoming less than rigorous species. And then Max Nordau and Theodor Herzl saw what happened to Alfred Dreyfus, and they were kind of radicalized. And they began to think about the need for Jews to protect themselves against anti-Semites. And they argued that Jews needed to stop being effeminate, bookish, wan ghetto dwellers. They needed to get out, and they needed to redeem their bodies. And he came up with a theory, which he called, with a new person that he wanted the Jew to become, which was called muscle eudentum. He wanted them to become muscle Jews. And the idea was that they would redeem their bodies, they would redeem the land, and they would be able to protect themselves so that no Cossack would be able to mess with them ever again. And Max Nordau was the forefather of the Jewish sports movement. And all through Vienna, Prague, Budapest, Berlin, there sprouted Jewish sports clubs. And in each of these clubs, there was a picture of a bearded man called Max Nordau hanging over the ping pong table or in the gymnasium. And the sports movements that he created ended up, they exist today in Israel. The Maccabi movements, there's Hapoel, which is the labor Zionist movement. The Jabotinskyites have Beitar, and there are soccer teams. There's Beitar Yerushalayim, which is the descendant of the Jabotinskyite sports movement. And so, I think that for Jews, when we talk about sports, even if we talk about it in this kind of fun sort of way, there is still, in some sort of vestigial, residual sort of way, some of these old questions that keep rattling around in our brain.
Can I ask you guys a question
yeah.
about this? So is this something that is unique to Jews? If we look, is there kind of a Chinese-American equivalent? Are we going to have...
Insanity.
Well, Jeremy Lin was the...
Jeremy Lin is one case, but do young Indian Americans sit and look and see what Indian Americans are making in
I think the thing is that
the NFL.
There was a sort of unique confluence, right? So Indian Americans are actually probably not at this point, but maybe Indian Americans 20 years ago were probably at roughly the equivalent point in terms of assimilation as Jews in the first part of the 20th century. The difference is, you know, sports is sort of a fait accompli right now as a massive thing. You know, basketball is the NBA now. You know, it's not this little bedraggled game played in cramped spaces on the Lower East Side. So it wasn't just that the Jews had this trajectory. They kind of had this trajectory at the exact right moment, is what I would say. That having said that, I mean, the whole Jeremy Lin thing, which was incredible, did, you know, what was very reminiscent of the way...
Here's another thing. That when when boxing and wrestling were kind of small sports, not national sports, there was so much more ethnicity wrapped into it. So on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, you had all these groups crammed together. You had kind of low-grade gang warfare that happened where Irish kids fought Jewish kids, you fought Italian kids. And that became one of the draws in the boxing ring, where promoters created kind of Jewish characters who went to fight against Irish characters. Jackie Kid Berg was a great English boxer who took off here. He would walk into the ring wearing a tallis, and he would wave the tallis over his head and whip the crowd into a frenzy and then stick it on his ring post. And then there were, this is part of the character, some Jewish kids didn't want their mothers to know that they were boxing, so they took on Irish identities. Mushi Callahan was Moshe Schneer. Artie O'Leary was Arthur Lieberman. And it went the other way, too. There were Irish boxers who took on Jewish names as well. And I think that you know, maybe that's part of the reason that, in New York, when you were rooting for Jewish boxers, you were rooting for the Jewish people. I mean, the same is true with Hank Greenberg. Hank Greenberg explicitly said he was trying to smash the ball to beat Hitler. And so he kind of held himself up as a tribal proxy. Let's open it up for some questions. I'm not surprised you have a question.
I'm not surprised you said it.
two quick comments and one question. Yeah. Oh, wait. Hold on one sec. It's for the podcast.
Okay. My first podcast, thank God. Okay. My dad, I'm in my mid-50s. My dad is in his 80s. And two quick comments. One was, my dad's day, and I don't know that much about it, there was the SPAS, the South Philadelphia Hebrew Association, and they had dances, and they were the Jewish Y, and I wish I knew more about it. When I was growing up in Germantown Jewish Center Synagogue, when Sandy Koufax didn't pitch, that was a big deal. And I know your website mentions Jane, and I read that book. It really didn't tell me a lot more. It was written many years after Sandy had retired. I remember after he left, he was on the Game of the Week, very soft-spoken. And then the book, and this is what I want you to clarify for me, intimates, you know, that he had a falling out with the Dodgers, not my lifestyle, but there were rumors of his sexuality. I could care less if he was... And, you know, I do a lot of volunteer tour guiding. I went to this wonderful new Jewish museum that we have in Philadelphia, and I said, gee, I wish you would just have a Sandy Koufax day, because this guy is arguably the best. He had the best 5 or 6 years of anybody, and I wish we could honor him. So I'd like a little clarification on the SPAS and anything on Sandy Koufax.
Well, the SPAS, we didn't do... There are many athletes who I wish, Jewish jocks figures who I wish we could have included in the book, and we just didn't. Eddie Gottlieb is, of course, you know, at the top of that list. So unfortunately, we didn't get to him. So the spa is that I have to refer to you to one of the couple books that have been.
But we could talk. You know, the Settlement House movement played a really important role in the development of Jewish jocks, and so part of the Settlement Houses grew out of. both the progressive movement. You had women like Jane Addams who were do-gooders who came into the ghetto to try to give a little bit of culture and education to these greenhorn immigrants. But in New York City, and I don't know if this is true in Philadelphia, you had German Jews who had arrived in New York many, many decades before the Eastern European Jews. And they'd become well established in the country. And they looked downtown at the new arrivals and they said, oi, they didn't say oi because they said, ugh. these new arrivals are making us look bad. They're not projecting the best image to the goyim. Let's try to not just give them a little culture. Let's try to make them real physical specimens. And so, you know, you had the 92nd Street Y began further downtown, but you had these settlement houses that the German Jews were funding, and they always had a gymnasium. And in those gymnasiums, they taught boxing and basketball was played, and they became these crucibles for Jewish sports.
As for Sandy, Jane's essay, you know, includes an episode that was completely left out of her book, which is namely the instance of Sandy Koufax attending her daughter's bat mitzvah. But she also goes into a lot of detail, again, I think more than she did in the book, which is an excellent biography, by the way, Jane's book. Jane also wrote a great book on Mickey Mantle, which has less Jewish resonance, of course, although not that much less, actually, probably. But Sandy was a very private guy, and he didn't fully realize when he decided not to pitch game one of the 1965 World Series, what that would mean to people, Jews and non-Jews. He wasn't even a particularly religious guy. It was more, he grew up not doing anything on Yom Kippur. He wasn't going to start doing anything on Yom Kippur. And it was a much more simple issue for him. And I think Jane would say that he was sort of almost, he would almost be taken aback by the meaning that this has had for the rest of the country. But in terms of your proposal for Sandy Koufax Day,
every day is Sandy Koufax Day with us.
Oh my God! I mean, he really is one of the best. And
did you, Mark or David, did either of you grow up with the mythology of Sandy?
Not really.
I mean, my dad is a Brooklynite.
Yeah, so I mean, a
little bit.
I was always told on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, you know, when I wanted to watch TV or something, you know, Sandy Koufax didn't pitch.
Remember when he didn't pitch in that day, and I guess Don Drysdale got lit up in like one of the early innings, and Walter Alston, the manager, came out to get him, and I think Don Drysdale said to him, "I bet you wish I was Jewish." one of my favorite stories ever.
All right, we got some questions here in the back.
I can speak loudly.
They want it for the podcast. We
can
hear
on the podcast, apparently.
Two things, by the way. You had mentioned about Kobe. Kobe Bryant's father was the girls' basketball coach at a Jewish day school here in Philadelphia.
Hey.
I knew Laura Marion. I didn't know that.
Jellybean Bryant was the coach.
I'm curious about whether this generation of younger Jews are so fixated. A number you had mentioned, baseball. I mean, Kinsler and Ike Davis and Ryan Braun, I mean, they're hardly Jewish.
Right.
And we were, in my generation, we were desperate to find somebody, you know, who had some Jewish connection. I mean, I told my son that Ralph Branca actually had a Jewish mother, and he said, so what? but to us, that really mattered. So I'm just wondering if, you know, for younger Jews, yeah, it's nice, but are they as fixated by the successful Jewish athlete, even if he's marginally Jewish? Again, it's anecdotal, but I think not.
Does anybody here have a strong sense of identification with Ryan Braun?
I mean,
does anybody have a strong sense of identification?
I think it's a great question. I mean,
he's got about one more day to be the reigning National League Most Valuable Player, right? Speaking as, you know, probably at least until I started working for a Jewish magazine, a typical young, not deracinated, but sort of Jewish by default, young Jew, I would have to say that if anything, I find in Jewishness and, you know, an identity to cling to in a way, in a very welcome way. I, you know, for me, it's always been, as I say, before I was a mildly professional Jew, I would very much, you know, do the thing with Ralph Branca. Obviously, that was a great article in the New York Times when they discovered Branca's mother, or Ryan Braun or Kevin Youkilis or Ike Davis or Ian Kinsler. You know, it's really a golden age of Jewish baseball. And, I mean, I think it's a really good question, and it's a question that goes to the heart of, you know, lots of greater Jewish communal concerns about, you know, subjects like intermarriage and really hot button issues. And I would just say, as someone who's at, you know, ground zero of that whole stuff of where young Jews are going, I would caution you not to be too pessimistic. I think young Jews continue to find Judaism to be something generally very welcome, and so young Jewish sports fans are going to be doing the same thing. And it might become a little more of a conceit. It might not be when you were growing up and it was literally out of desperation. You had no other choice but to do this. I get that. I get that for maybe someone of my generation, it's a little bit more of a choice to do this. But I think it's a choice most of us are making.
Do you guys have, sense. I mean, why, Mark, you seem really genuinely into the subject of Jewish jocks. Why?
I think probably it's just, as a kid, there were so few of them. I mean, I think it goes directly to what you were saying. It's still, I think, really cool that you know, when you hear, you know, X, I mean, I like open up this book and I'm like, oh, wow, he's Jewish or she's Jewish and so forth. I guess I'm just not in touch with enough young sports fans today. I have three daughters, not that they're not sports fans, but I don't have a sense of, you know, the gee whiz that there used to be. But it is remarkable, I mean, like I was saying before, like the level of conversation that this can elicit and the level of animated sort of reaction that it's almost surprise. I mean, I remember in the early days of the World Wide Web, there were these websites like Jews in Sports, and you'd go on and there'd be these lists, the top 100 Jews in sports. And like once you get to like number 13 or 14, there'd be a bunch of question marks like, is he Jewish? You know, Matthew Schneider. It's sort of a Jewish name, a Montreal hockey player or anything. But I don't know. I do think I still, I mean, I would, at a very base level, I think it's cool. I just don't know, you know, whether there's a gradation now compared to how it might have been.
I did, when this book came out, just some back-of-the-envelope math. And based on sort of inferences, I came up with a number that there are about 1,500 to 2,000 boys who are bar mitzvahed every year. And so that this book, they're going to, I figure that they're going to sell two copies at least for every boy who's having a bar mitzvah, because it'll be like a default gift. So maybe it will cause a renaissance of love of Jewish athletes. My own view, actually, for what it's worth, is somewhere totally different, which is that I do think there's been a decline, is my suspicion, and I don't see any problem with it. It seems good. Doesn't I find the whole obsession slightly bizarre. I'm glad. I want Frank and Mark to sell a billion copies of this book, but the obsession does seem slightly
atavistic.
It's atavistic is not the right word.
I think obsession is too strong a word. I think it's a popular and recurring conversation piece.
I don't see what's so wrong with the conversation, obviously, given that we edited a book about it. But I don't know.
It's just you don't find it like kind of embarrassing. It's like a bunch of Jewish journalists, like we're, you know.
This is a ghetto just, Jewish attitude. I think the real muscle Jewish attitude is stand proud, man.
No, but I'm a muscle Jew. I'm happy to go out and play sports, but it just doesn't, like, my sports playing doesn't feel to me connected to my Jewishness. It doesn't matter to me if I'm playing sports with Jews or if there's some good soccer player who's Jewish. None of it makes any difference. It's like,
I actually think that
it reflects a sense of Jewish identity, which is very insulated, separated from the kind of mainstream American identity, and feels itself to be defensive, which I just don't think the modern American Jewish identity is or shouldn't be.
I think a couple things. One is that there's a kind of jokey quality to the whole conversation, and therefore a jokey quality to the whole book, which is very different. It's in a way a type of tribalism that's so absurd that it's okay.
Right. It's definitely more innocent than other forms of Jewish tribalism.
But I think that there are a couple other things going on. One is, I think that there are, you know, the story of Sandy, which you recall, I think is something that is kind of, it is almost at like the center of the Jewish American experience. I mean, there's a reason that Sandy Koufax is kind of enshrined in, handed down from generation to generation, which is that experience sums up what it means to be a Jew in America more than anything else, which is that the guy was able to kind of beg off of a World Series game on religious grounds and Nobody, no, there weren't, there, there wasn't a mob that descended on his house because of it. He was applauded for it. And, that's the type of acceptance that Jews haven't found in any other country in the Western world.
I would also take up the challenge on even more on your grounds. And I suspect if we had a conversation about non-sports areas of Jewishness, we'd find similar disagreements. But I grew up as someone, again, like, I mean, I grew up definitely in a Jewish community, but also definitely with the understanding that previous generations of Jews were more different from the rest of the population than I was, which is, that's not something we disagree on. That's an empirical fact. Where we would, maybe disagree is the wrong word, but where we would feel differently is I kind of miss, I can't miss it, obviously, because I don't know what it was like, but I kind of wish I had that experience, and which is why I find myself calling Dolph Shays every few months. And I think that's...
That's just weird.
People want a sense of tribal identity, absolutely. Sure. And deracination of Jews is, I can see why that would be of concern, and you find meaning and you're searching for
just to make about this book, which is that, you know, I bet you 3/4 of this room here received for the Bar Bat Mitzvah one of the other books about Jews and sports, right? And there's a lineage. And I know that when my father, you know, there was on my father's shelf a book that he got about great Jews and sports from as a Bar Mitzvah. And I remember seeing this book and really enjoying it when I was a kid. But there was... These were superheroes who were being created, and there was this worship, and these guys were definitely going off to fight on behalf of the Jewish people. That's how they were perceived. I mean, especially the pugilists, but also Hank and Sandy. And I think this book is a little is reflective of a different moment in Jewish American identity, where there's no need to valorize or heroize any of these characters. In fact, there are quite a few scoundrels in the book. There's Arnold Rothstein, who stole the 1919 World Series. There's Jack Molinas, who ran one of the great point-shaving schemes in American basketball history. He was one of the greatest basketball players to emerge from
Columbia
New York
grad
City.
Grad like Frank and me.
And, but unfortunately, he got busted and thrown out of the league his rookie season, even though he'd been the 6th all-around pick and an all-star. And he went to Brooklyn Law School. And as a lawyer, orchestrated one of this massive point shaving scheme where he bought point guards across the country, went to Attica for 7 years, emerged as a triple X movie mogul, an early porn mogul, and was gunned down on his patio in Malibu with one of his triple X girlfriends. So there's no sugarcoating here. Yes.
Recurring.
Wait for the microphone.
Oh, we have some good local history coming.
The Gershman Y, which is now an art school, but they still have activities there, Jewish-oriented, has a Jewish Sports Hall of Fame. And there's also in the Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts, has stuff about the Philadelphia Spots. We saw it. So,
if
sure
you want
if
to put any induct anybody into the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame this year, I think you've got some good candidates up here.
Well, I didn't know Kobe Bryant coached at Akiva. That's amazing. His father did. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Jelly Bean. Well, let's keep it going.
Here or someone else. I wondered, did you let the writers pick who they wanted to write about, or did you assign them someone?
Well, that's we actually have some objects lessons up here who can describe the experience. Did we tap you, or I mean, we tapped you to write, but I don't think we said Carrie Strug. I think you suggested Carrie Strug.
I like did a Wikipedia page and just sort of I did one of those the Wikipedia of Jews and sports and was like, who is interesting? It was I came down for me to Lyle Alzado or Carrie Strug.
Lyle Alzado was Jewish.
Yeah.
And the other questions were for a tennis player. Did you consider Vic Satius at all, who was a Philadelphian, I believe,
yeah.
And coming more out of left field? What about Rod Carew?
Okay. Yeah. What about Rob Carew? The great Rob Carew story. Do you want to weigh in on anything?
I you would know it better. No, I think he's not Jewish, right?
No,
he did not convert. Common misconception is that he converted. He married a Jewish woman, had children with her. They were raised Jewish. And in the Adam Sandler song, Adam Sandler says he converted. In fact, he did not convert.
Well, no, but the controversy arises from a famous...
But that's still an interesting
thing. He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated,
right.
And he was wearing a chai, And it's like, come on, if you're going to wear a high on the cover of Sports Illustrated, people will talk.
I just want to point out that when Mark was telling that little story, or that explanation about Rod Crew, about two-thirds of the room was nodding their heads as if they'd already heard it. I mean, that to me is cool.
You know, we have two tennis players in the book. You know, actually, tennis has a fair number of decent Jews you could put in. We have decent. I mean... Well, as opposed to exactly.
Rene Richards might be indecent.
Well, so exactly. Rene Richards is one of the Jews that we have in the book. Yeah, nobody knew Rene Richards was Jewish. Yeah,
Richard Raskin. She was.
That counts as two.
And we have Harold Solomon. We have Harold Solomon, right? Exactly. So three. yes.
I wanted to just throw out four names that haven't come up yet. And see if I can get comments. Starting with Harry Litwack, who coached Temple for a long time, and I don't know if he's in the Hall of Fame, but he was one of the great college basketball coaches. Second one that I would put maybe on your starting five might replace one of the guys is a guy named Art Heyman from
Duke. Art Heyman, of course.
Yeah.
Art Heyman,
a good pro.
If you go on YouTube, you can see the brawl between Duke and UNC that was started by Art Heyman and Larry Brown, who were rivals from Brooklyn, and then Larry Brown was UNC, Art Heyman was Duke, and they had a big brawl. Art Heyman just passed away.
I didn't know that, but he was college player of the year. So.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
He could at least be a sub on your team.
Absolutely. You know,
the third one, you didn't mention anything about Jewish football players, and the only one that comes to my mind is Sid Luckman.
Well, Sid Luckman's in the book.
Okay, My fourth one was Mark Spitz. You didn't.
Okay, Mark Spitz is. How could you have a book about Jewish sports and not have Mark Spitz in the book? He doesn't come off especially well, I have to say, in the essay. But like I said, it's a warts and all portrayal of this Jewish jocks book. With football, you're suggesting that football may not be a very Jewish discipline. And in fact, there's a strong argument to be made that the Jewish imprint on football is quite strong. It wasn't just Sid Luckman. There was Benny Friedman, who played for the University of Michigan and the New York Football Giants. And he and Sid Luckman essentially invented the position of modern quarterback. The modern offensive scheme that predated Eric Coryell was invented by a guy called Sid Gilman, who was the offensive coordinator for the San Diego Chargers. We have an essay about Al Davis. He's a Jew. We can't disown that guy, even though try as hard as we might. He is a Shonda.
We have an essay on Ron Mix, who is an offensive lineman for both Sid Gilman and Al Davis.
Was Steve Mix Jewish? Of the Sixers? Anyone? Okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay. All right, one more question. Yes.
This is two overlapping questions referring to Chariots of Fire. Harold Abraham in the book, number one? And number two, there's a kind of a Sandy Koufax moment. One of the Christian players on the team refuses to run, and you know the conflict between public acclaim and personal conscience seems to reflect that thing.
Yeah. So... No, Harold Abraham's not in the book. Let's go through the omissions. There's been a couple that have been cited. The biggest other omissions are Abe Saperstein, the guy who founded and coached the Harlem Globetrotters.
Not a Philadelphia, but a New Jerseyite. Ed and Steve Stable both could have been in. Mm. Unfortunately,
yeah.
Steve
Stable. There's no baseball. We have. We have maybe five essays.
But we don't have Lip Pike, who was the first professional baseball player ever back in the 1870s.
Nor do we have Mo Berg, the catcher who was a spy, who could speak 12 different languages but hit none of them.
No Ryan Braun, right?
No Ryan Braun, who would be an interesting subject, but when we were writing the book, it was unclear whether he was innocent or guilty. It's hard to write about a guy.
It still is, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, anyone else?
There's a few others that we could have. Dara Torres, who's half Jewish. Oh, yeah. But we tried to get a pretty comprehensive set, tried to get a bunch of sports, tried to get a bunch of different time periods, and wanted to include some kookier ones like Don Lerman, who... Has anyone been to the Wing Bowl at the... well, so Don Lerman was the Ben Franklin of competitive eating and invented the water method by which people train. I know, exactly. That's you'll have to read about him. So we couldn't have both the necessaries like Mark Spitz, the people like Al Davis who are sort of trying to make our point, and the people like the bullfighter and the competitive eater and the ping pong player and the chess player. You know, it pretty soon adds up to 50 essays. And
you know what's kind of funny is that we've been, Jewish jock. Nobody's. I guess I preempted the objection that Al Davis or Bud Selig, who's in the book, Bud Selig, arguably a Shonda, are not jocks. What's Bud Selig doing in a book about jocks? Well, you know, obviously we're aware that Bud Selig is not much of an athletic specimen. And we're playing off of that old Jewish joke when we have that expansive quality. But you go back and you look at some of the older books about Jewish athletes, the ones that are really hero worshipy, they include Bobby Fischer, and they include other chess grandmasters. And so I think that there is this kind of for Jews to include some of these more mental vocations in the broader concept of athletics is a venerable tradition in its own right. Thank you all so much
for
coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.